When I say the name Tony Gilman, there are many Chicagoans who will instantly know who Tony Gilman is. And then there will be some people who say, now wait a minute, Tony Gilman, wait a minute, I know. And then if I say television show Down You Go with Bergen Evans, and oh yes, the glamorous panelists on that program.
The crazy panelists.
And then there are people who will say, oh, Tony Gilman, that's Radio Chicago. And we're happy to be here with Tony Gilman.
Thank you, Chuck.
Welcome.
It's so good to be here with you and Ellen.
Thank you. You got a start in radio in Chicago pretty much at a great time, wasn't it?
Well, it was really the cradle mm-hmm. of radio. The song that Judy Garland sings, I Was Born in a Trunk at the Princess Theater mm-hmm. in Pocatello, Idaho. I was literally born on a soapbox in the Drake Hotel, WGN Studios, mm-hmm. and up in the penthouse in Chicago, Illinois. It was the cradle of radio. I did the first soap opera ever on radio, Chicago, New York, or anyplace else. It was born in Chicago at WGN. And my father was then production manager, so it does sound like nepotism, mm-hmm. doesn't it? But actually, he didn't hire me. Erna Phillips, who was writing for my father and writing Painted Dreams.
That was the very first.
That was the very first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when Erna Phillips wrote it, she never changed the names. It was a story of Mother Moynihan. My own grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was Margaret Ryan Moynihan.
Oh, so she was close with your family then.
Well, mm-hmm. she was. My father introduced Erna mm-hmm. to us as a family, invited her out to dinner. He had used her as an actress and a writer, and he wanted to start a soap opera, much like the serials in the Chicago Tribune. Every day, a short mm-hmm. chapter. And people enjoyed that while going down to the loop on the L. They'd read their serial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it killed the time between Howard Street and the merchandise part.
Yes.
And so he said, I want to write about a typical American family. And she said, I don't know a typical American family. She was a school teacher from, mm-hmm. Had been teaching in Dayton, Ohio. And she said, no, my family... English was not spoken at home. It was, I heard German and I heard Yiddish, mm-hmm. but I didn't know a typical American family. So he said, I'll introduce you to mine. And so she wrote about my grandmother, and my mother was there, so she put her in as a character, played by Bess Johnson. My aunt, who was played by Irene Wicker. And then her first Christmas show, of the serial, she wrote in a little orphan girl named Tony.
Little Orphan Tony.
Yes, Little Orphan Tony, yes. And I couldn't make Orphan Annie. I auditioned, and my father didn't know it. It was a blind audition. Mm-hmm. And Henry Selinger, who was then running the station, said, that voice, that's our Annie. And my father said, it is not. That is my daughter, Tony, and she isn't old enough to read. She can't read a script every day. So I didn't get Annie, but fortunately they found Shirley Bell, who is just marvelous.
Oh, yes.
And a year later, I did get to play on the show because I started first grade up at St. Jerome's mm-hmm. in Rogers Park, and I could read by then. But my first shows, I stood on a soapbox because I was so short and, 5 years old.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then I memorized my scripts for the first year.
Well, how did you, who helped you memorize the scripts?
My grandmother, Mother Moynihan.
Mother Moynihan.
My
uh-huh.
grandmother uh-huh. would take the script the night before I was to do the broadcast, and while I was lying in bed going off to sleep, she would sit there and give me my lines. And then...
No Little Red Riding Hood for you.
No, and then, no, it was learning lines
yeah,
right away.
Yeah.
But she had been doing that since I was in the high chair, teaching me songs and poetry.
Uh-huh.
And she even taught me Shakespeare when I was a little girl.
Really?
So, to remind me of what my next line would be, she would draw hieroglyphics. And if I would have to be saying on the show, Mother Moynihan, are we going to church now? she would draw a little steeple, a little church for me. Or, oh, I'd like to go to school. She'd draw a little schoolhouse with a bell on it, you know. So I really did my first script reading by hieroglyphics, done by Grandma.
As you remember that.
Yes.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I think before I even thought of doing radio or being on a stage or anything, it took nothing, just about three people in our living room, for me to go in and start entertaining. I used to shock when my mother would have a bridge club meeting at home. I would purposely walk through the room and do a real comic trip and fall, and all the women would go, oh, Tony. I had done it on purpose. So I had to do this business.
Now, you said your father told Erna Phillips that she should come to your home to see a typical American family.
Yes. Sunday dinner at our house.
But was that a typical? Were you a typical American family? You
well,
got
I
the kids ready
so.
To go in the radio, and your father is a broadcaster already.
Yes. Well, Papa was a Chicagoan by birth, but had studied in Europe with Adhokar Shevchik in violin, and 4 years of composition with Antonín Dvořák, and he was a concert violinist. But in the Depression in Chicago, they were closing down symphony. You couldn't get arrested as a classical musician in Chicago. And he went back to help his father salvage in the Depression his lumber business in Chicago. And he had to work. And so he was hired by Henry Selinger to be the musical contractor for WGN. And little by little it evolved that Papa had so much background in theater and vaudeville, as a musical act in vaudeville, that he turned out to be a producer and start producing soap operas, musical shows. He was producer of the great Chicago concerts at Grant Park, the first ones. And there's a whole history of radio that began at WGN. It then moved over to NBC, CBS, and then my sister Lucy came in the business. And Lucy was Lucy Moran on Today's Children, which was a spinoff from Painted Dreams.
Well, how did that happen? There was Painted Dreams was on WGN, and then Erna Phillips left that show, right?
Yeah. Well, Erna Phillips, there was a lawsuit on with the Tribune and Erna Phillips, and Erna had created the show because of my father's request to do it, to write the show. And WGN claimed that the show belonged to them. And Erna Phillips said, well, no, the show belongs to me. And they said, oh, no. And she didn't have a contract. Mm-hmm. But they said, and they went to court, and it was a court trial for several years. But Erna Phillips was fired. And when the upstairs fired her, of course, everything came from the top, Colonel McCormick.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when Erna Phillips was fired, my father walked with her. And following also came Irene Wicker, who Papa produced the
Singing Lady.
Singing Lady, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And all these people walked. We all went back to WGN eventually, but this was a very bitter lawsuit as to ownership of the first soap opera.
So Erna Phillips then kind of
changed
the characters around.
She never did anything after that, right? She only wrote almost every soap opera
right.
in the business,
right.
including years later. I did Woman in White out of NBC Chicago in 37, 38 with McDonald Carey. Years later, I ended up in Los Angeles doing Days of Our Lives with McDonald Carey. And so it was a whole career out of Chicago radio. It was still Erna Phillips originally conceiving Days of Our Lives.
What are some of the other shows you did out of Chicago?
Well, Mert and Marge over WBBM. The other Erna Phillips shows, my goodness, you know, she did Road of Life, Bess Flynn also, who replaced Erna as Mother Moynihan and wrote the show. Then Bess took me on to New York for Life Begins, which I did for 3 years for Campbell Soup Company. I'll tell you the show that was my first big audience show. My sister Lucy and I did First Nighter with Donna Meachie over at NBC. Mm-hmm. And I played because they hadn't yet discovered for the next year to 2 years a boy actor outside of Alan Barrick, who played Joe Corntassel on Orphan Annie.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
We hadn't yet met Mel Torme or mm-hmm. little Georgie Goble. And so I played little boys' parts. And I used to borrow little boys' outfits from our neighbor across the street, Tommy Ryan, who later became a singer with Chuck Foster's orchestra. And I would dress up as a little boy and tuck my pigtails, my braids, up under the, a little cap. And Lucy played all the little girls, and I played all the little boys.
Well, were you, in effect, disguising yourself as a boy to get the job or for the audience?
No, they didn't have a little boy, but we had an audience.
For the audience.
A studio audience.
Yes, uh-huh.
That's right.
First Nighter.
Oh, no, I didn't. They knew I was a little girl, but they wanted for the studio audience to believe that this child was a boy. So I was trying to talk like little boys instead of little girls.
We've heard that voice. Heard that voice on so many of the shows, yeah.
Sure.
There was a New York actress by the name of Sarah Fussell.
Yes.
Who did all the little boy
That's
things
right.
from New York as well, yeah. So they're right in there.
We all had the double. there were so many soap operas where we were talking mm-hmm. to ourselves. I remember doing a show on Campbell Soup Playhouse, where I think it was a show I did with Frederick March and Florence Eldridge, and mm-hmm. I was a woman having a baby, and they needed an Italian woman to be the midwife. And so I'm going, oh, I can't stand it. I just can't stand it. That's all right, darling. I'll take care of you. You're going to be all right. And, oh, please, help me, help me. You know, this is what you did on radio. They could get you to do two parts for
I
one salary.
I thought you were going to say you also with a baby cry, too.
That, oh, sure.
It would have been a one-woman show.
Sure. I think everyone, as you know, at these old-time radio mm-hmm. meetings, you talk to any of them. Jackson Beck, who
yes.
is here, and Ted Reed, who is here, Elliot Reed, and just meeting all these people, they would do as many as four or five voices on a show.
Sure. Until the AFTRA.
Well, it was AFTRA.
AFTRA came in and said, no, you can only double.
Once.
Two characters in a show.
Right. And the third one, you got paid.
Yeah.
And if you did six, you got paid three times.
But some directors would prefer to have a single actor doing all the multiple parts, even though it meant additional pay, because they knew what that actor could do.
That's right.
And they had less bodies to worry about, I suspect.
That's right. And there were some mm-hmm. studios we worked in that were not much bigger than mm-hmm. what you called an announcer's booth.
Right. When you were doing First Nighter, were you around the preteen age?
Oh, no. When I did First Nighter, I was 7 years old.
Yeah, really young.
And, then I left. You see, I worked in Chicago radio over at KYW. I did Home Folks, Erna Phillips shows, and I was working at NBC, at Merton Marge at mm-hmm. CBS, and then at age 10, I did a play in Chicago in 1933. Now you know my age, don't you?
Well, we won't.
At age 10 and 33, very simple arithmetic. Uh-huh. I went to New York
uh-huh.
And did my first Broadway show with Will Gear, Gramps uh-huh. from the Waltons. And so I stayed pretty much in New York through those years, but did come back to do shows like Woman in White at NBC for Erna Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, a show like that, would have a part that would be continuous for some length of time,
oh,
right?
Oh, yes, yes. But when I remember when I was doing Woman in White playing Betty Adams, I don't know how I can remember all these characters' names, but I was called to New York to do a play, and also Bess Flynn wanted me to do this show for Campbell Soup. So I was replaced by a girl from Duluth, Minnesota, called Peggy Knudsen. And then I had to go out on the road out of New York on a show, and I was replaced once again in New York by an actress from Chicago named Peggy Knudsen. And Peggy and I became very, very close friends, and until her death about 10 years ago, we were very, very close. Our kids thought of us as their aunts. And it was very close. And Peggy went on to become, well, her father-in-law was Jim Jordan.
And she married Jim's son.
Yes, Jim's son. And so her three kids were Jordan kids.
Yes.
And, you know, it almost melded. When I joined AFRA, I was out in Los Angeles doing Mrs. Wallington on the Eddie Cantor Show. But Chicago, of course, is my birthplace. Born at Swedish Covenant Hospital, North Side. And I did go to school there. And, you know, it's like my husband, Gordon Davis. No matter where he's lived, all over America and Europe and the Orient, he's still a Bostonian.
Yes, yeah. Well, so you'll always be a Chicago.
That's right, I'll always be a Chicago.
How did you get from, you mentioned that you left Chicago, went to New York, came back a few times from New York. You worked radio in New York as well.
Oh, yes, yes. It, instead of being a theater actress who had to work at a waiting table at Schraff's or Christmas season at Macy's, to keep their body and soul together until the next play, I had it made because I just went over and did a radio show. So always, you know, acting. So, but radio kept us all alive.
New York had a lot of the major shows in the evening, and then they did a number of soap operas too.
Oh, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. My first soap opera there was Young Widow Brown. And I'm looking forward today. I'm going to see Florence Freeman, Young Widow Brown.
Ellen Brown.
Yes. Oh, yes. And such a beautiful lady. And I'm having such a thrill being with George Ansborough, who's the announcer on that show. Yeah. I told George yesterday, I said, do you realize when I was 16 years old, I had a mad crush on you. I was so in love with you. But you were a much older man. How old were you then? And he said, I was 23. And, of course, at 16, I was a much older man. There is a camaraderie among old-time radio people that we were such a family. You know, people ask about famous people I have known. Very, very often people will talk about radio actors and I'll say, oh, well, yes, well, you know who played that part? Nancy Reagan's mother, Nancy Davis. You know? And her father was a surgeon in Chicago. And her mother, Edith Davis, was working on Erna Phillips soap operas. And we were all making magnificent salaries in those days, $5 a show. That was
pretty good salary at that time.
Yes,
right? Sure.
Yes, we could make a living at $5 a show, and if you were doing four or five shows a day, you were rolling in it.
And it was wonderful then to get a continuing part in a program, because there you'd always be. Did you have to do much repeating broadcast for the West Coast or something like that?
Oh, we even have jokes about, and now let's do it for the West Coast. When I was out on the West Coast, I thought, oh, well, this is fine. Now I don't have to do the West Coast broadcasts. Wrong again. I was doing the one for the East Coast. So when I did the Cantor Show, I was doing Mrs. Wallington on that one. We would
the
rehearse.
So-called wife of Jimmy Wallington, the announcer.
Yes, yes. I was all of 13 then.
You were 13 years old playing the wife of his announcer?
Well, see, I grew very tall when I was 13 years old, and I couldn't play kid parts anymore. And I had this voice that didn't sound like a kid's voice anymore. So I couldn't get a job as a kid actor anymore, and I wasn't the ingenue.
But weren't they paying attention to the voice and not the
Well, you know, we had studio audiences, too. We did that at the
So some of it was keyed for the studio
audience.
Oh, we did
it at the Vine Street Theater, costume and all. It was really a big show. But the child singer on the show was 2 years older than I was. Deanna Durbin.
Yeah.
But we would rehearse a whole day. Then the next day at the Vine Street Theater, we would have a audience dress.
Mm-hmm.
Then we would do the next day an East Coast broadcast, late afternoon, mm-hmm. for an audience. Mm-hmm. Then we'd get a break, very short break, and then we do the broadcast for the third time for the West Coast. Because we didn't have that delay recording. There was no taping it. It was live, live, live.
Oh, yeah. And were there any changes made generally or often or occasionally between the first and the second broadcast?
Rarely. Particularly working with some of the people I'd work with, like Olson and Johnson or Eddie Cantor or Milton Berle or, these wonderful comedians. The scripts you knew stayed the same, but you never knew what the ad-lib was going to be with these comedians, and so it did change in that way. You played because they were good theater actors as well. they knew how to wing it, ad-lib.
Eddie Cantor was particularly a visual comedian and played a lot to the studio audience.
Oh, yes. If there would be a laugh. But, we didn't have a thing called the laugh track.
Never.
This annoys me still. I turn off shows where they're feeding in that laugh track. It isn't that funny, and I wonder what the people are laughing about. We didn't have that, but what Eddie Cantor would do, if he'd say some kind of a line that maybe was a little suggestive, of course we never said bad things on radio, and the laugh wasn't on the rehearsal as big as he wanted, or on the dress with the audience, and it wasn't as big as he wanted, when we hit the air to do the East Coast broadcast, and the laugh wasn't there when he was trying to make time with Jimmy Wallington's wife.
Uh-huh.
Here I am, 13 years old, standing there, and Eddie Cantor would say the line, and then do a high kick and wrap his leg around my waist.
Oh, my.
And the audience, of course, would fall apart. So people at home, when they'd hear this audience laughing, they'd have to say, that's funny.
Yeah.
Maybe, without the laugh track, we wouldn't think all these things were funny. But it was really funny. I think
that was the thing about those, especially the comedians on the air. They had to depend on the material and their timing and the delivery, because they never could rely on a laugh track, because there was no such thing as a laugh track.
Right, that's right. Yeah. We just heard a rebroadcast of Fibber McGee and Molly last night.
Uh-huh.
Those were funny scripts.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And when you think, of course, there was no audience on Vic and Sade, but the writing of Vic and Sade was so funny. You'd laugh until you cried. I think the writing on the Fred Allen show and the characters on there, like Teddy Bergman.
Mm-hmm.
Who,
Alan Reed, he was.
Alan Reed, that's right. He took the name Alan Reed later. But the things that he and Charlie Cantor would do were so funny, and the lines were well written. And I laughed last night, this actress who was impersonating, and a beautiful impersonation of Marion Jordan as Molly. Let me tell you, they were doing old lines. They were funny.
Yeah. Well, that's why that stuff holds up so well today, because it was quality material that the writers produced, and the performers were quality performers. And you're one of those people who provided so much in the radio days. Of the radio days, now I know you went on to do some television and movie work and stage work, and even today you're still doing some theatrical work going on, and some regional theatrical work, I guess, right?
Old actresses never die. They simply move to Cape Cod. but you can still call them.
Of the radio, of your radio career, Tony, what seems to stand out as a highlight?
I would say the opportunity as a radio actor to work with some really great actors. In doing the MGM show, I and an actress named Annette Fabre were the two stock actresses. We picked up all the odd parts on the MGM show. But I got to work with the most wonderful actors. One week it would be a picture that Joan Crawford was pushing, and just the whole MGM string of actors. And also, I'd say that was a highlight, and working on Showboat on the coast with Charlie Wininger.
Oh.
It was some of the most delightful people.
So was Lanny Ross on that?
Oh, yes.
Sure, Annette Henshaw?
Yes. Meredith Wilson was conductor of the orchestra. That, and I think also working the Campbell Soup Playhouse, where I got to work with Humphrey Bogart and Florence Eldridge and Frederick March. Outstanding actors. And, you know, to this day, I still think that with all the fine Meryl Streeps and actresses of that caliber, I still think that the absolutely greatest actress of all filmdom and everything else was Katharine Hepburn. I still think so. She is still numero uno. When I moved to Cape Cod, having mostly a Chicago accent, I figured they'll only accept me as a native if I talk Cape Cod talk. But since I hadn't learned it yet, you got that learned it yet?
Yeah.
I hadn't learned it yet. I decided that if I talked to everyone as Katharine Hepburn, that they would understand what I was saying, and it worked.
If only I could do Spencer Tracy now, it would be great.
And, you know, still the great, great movies are Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn.
It's obvious that you have a great love of life and a great love and respect for the work that you did, and I think of radio.
And an abiding love for the radio actor.
Absolutely. Yeah.
They're still here. They're still around. I'm having such a great time at the old time radio meeting fellows, all the crushes I had on these fellows, and they don't believe it. And then they are saying,
"Well, they're not telling you, but you broke a few hearts too, I think, over the years."
Oh no!
Yeah.
Oh, no! I couldn't have.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing some time today and for all the work you did in radio and your dedication to that the genre of entertainment, which is substantial.
Well, let me thank you, Chuck, for keeping us all in the memory of those who still enjoy old-time radio.
Oh, thank you so
and
much.
And you're a good guy to do this.
Thank you, Tony Gilman. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck.
Radio actress Tony Gilman has a fond recollection of the subject of our program this afternoon, Walter Tetley. Tony?
Oh, well, Chuck, Walter Tetley is one of the dearest memories of my life. When I went to New York as a child actress, and my first jobs were in radio before I did a theater play, Walter was a child actor. We got to work together in quite a few shows. But the most I can say about Walter Tetley, I'm sure audiences still remember Gildersleeve and all the great shows that he did. He was the brat voice on every show. What we call shilled. I was a shill for comedians, too. But Walter shilled for Fred Allen. You name it, he was one. The most child actor in demand. Now, Walter grew older, but he never grew up. Mm-hmm. And he was the kindest, most generous person. And it came naturally from his mother, Jessie Tetley, who was a terrific Scotswoman. And they came from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most of northern New Jersey is populated by the Scots. They should have named Northern New Jersey, Nova Scotia.
Oh.
And, of course, right across the river is New York and the mecca of broadcasting of the great days of radio after Chicago, to New York. Walter Tetley, what I can remember most about him was the kindness of Walter and his mother to other actors. Walter was always there for his friends. He was the nicest friend to other actors. I would say the word love is what suits the feeling of most people about Walter Tetley who knew him and worked with him. When we would be coming to California, Mama would maybe go out there and she'd stay with Jesse Tetley, his mother. See, stage mothers were to be feared.
Yes.
Except years later, a director said to me, Herschel Williams, how is your mother? And I said, oh, did you know my mother? He said, you bet I knew your mother. I said, but she was never around the studio. He said, oh, yes, she was. What I knew about your mother, what I liked, was she was always sitting far away from the studio, reading a book or doing some sewing. And the other one who was a non-stage mother was Jessie Tetley, Walter's mother. She never said, oh, you must use my Walter. He's so good. Walter spoke for himself. Everyone knew he was good. He didn't need a mother pushing him. So Jessie was just there because the law said you had to have a parent there if you were under age. And Walter had a brother who was a dear guy, Al, and he developed multiple sclerosis. And he ended his life in a wheelchair. But when we'd go out to California to do a show, we would stay sometimes with the Tetleys at Walter's ranch out in the valley. And we'd sit around that swimming pool, and I watched Walter with such kindness and love taking care of his brother. This was his big brother, quite able, and then all of a sudden confined to a wheelchair. I think that care, and my last memories of Walter, I'm sorry to say, are because he was hit on his little motorbike one day.
And it was a terrible accident, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. It put him into the hospital, and I spent quite a bit of time visiting him at the hospital. It was a long convalescence. I don't think he ever really recovered from it, although he did get to walk again. But it was very sad that Walter, who was so kind and loving and supportive of anyone who was infirmed, ill, that he should end his life so handicapped himself.
Yes.
But he was a beautiful, generous, kind, loving man, friend, son, brother, and you can't get much more talented than Walter Tetley.
That's for sure. Yeah. Tony Gilman, what a nice tribute to Walter Tetley.
Yes, I loved him. I still love him.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chuck.